This is Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, I'm Jason Kelly.
And I'm Carol Masser. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. This week, we'll bring you some of the most important and informative coronavirus conversations we've had throughout the week on our daily radio show. And I was thinking, Jason, here we are, week 10. When we began working from home, spring was just getting underway. And now here we are, kind of the unofficial start to summer, Memorial Day weekend.
Yeah, it's really fascinating to think about. And the whole notion of 10 weeks of doing this. I mean, when was last time you did something for 10 weeks? You know,
right.
Like something really supremely and radically different. Our world has changed, and that is for sure.
Right. And this week involves so many conversations over what is turning out to be one of the most difficult questions of our time. It's about reopening the economy. Do we do it too soon or too late? And what will be the cost of either decision? That, in fact, is our cover story of the magazine's double issue this week. We'll have more on that a little bit later on.
Well, and we heard from some really interesting people, some very familiar names, folks you've heard on our air before, and some new voices. Klaus Zellmer, he's the president and CEO of Porsche Cars North America. Also, Ian Schrager.
Yeah, Ian Schrager, man, when it comes to hospitality and innovation in hotels and really living overall, this is the guy. He has been at it for 50 years. So we caught up with him about the impact and really what everything is going to look like, and especially for big cities, right? What it looks like later on.
We also heard from Facebook's Sheryl Sandberg, author of Lean In, and we felt like we were leaning in to this notion of what's going to happen to small businesses. That is one of the biggest questions facing the U.S. economy. First up, though, we spoke with Dr. Bill Hazeltine. He is the chairman and president of Access Health International, incredibly well-known in the world of medicine. He has worked on some of the biggest medical questions of our time.
Right. He's now got a nonprofit, but let's not forget, he founded more than a dozen companies, including Human Genome Sciences. He reminds us that testing, tracing, and strict isolation will be the only way we really beat the virus.
I see it as a small step forward and a lot of hype.
Interesting. Tell us more.
Yeah, explain why.
Well, there are 8 patients that they reported. The data is not public. We can't evaluate it. We don't know what actually happened. And there are other reports of published papers by scientists around the world who've done at least what they've done and perhaps more. So that's why I say it's a little bit of news and a lot of hype.
And so when you look at that, is this just people really, the market in particular, and maybe us just as human beings, looking and grabbing on to some sliver of hope here, Dr. Hazeltine?
You know, hope has been the handmaiden of scoundrels for generations. It's what allows us to be conned. We need hope, but hope is also dangerous. We have to be careful.
Yeah.
With it. I'm not saying that vaccine won't work. I'm just saying it's a very slender thread to move a market.
Well, having said...
go ahead.
No. Well, you know what? Let me just... Because we want to continue this line of thought. We did, though, catch up. Our Bloomberg News team on the TV side caught up with the Moderna CEO, Stéphane Bancel, and talked about phase 3, the trial specifically that they expect by July. Let's just listen to a snippet of that interview.
We are finalizing the protocol for the phase 3, which is the last clinical study before approval, which we are hoping to start in July of this year. The study will be several thousand healthy subjects across many countries. We are finalizing the protocol as we speak with the FDA, and we are hoping that people can start in July, as is our plan.
So phase 3, as we know, and you certainly know, Dr. Hazeltine, is an important process, but it reminds us that there's still a lot to be known, right?
There's a lot to be known. No, as far as we know, there's been no real challenge in a human being. And I can say that I've been reviewing the literature of vaccine efforts over many years, first with SARS, then with MERS, and other coronaviruses. This is not a simple problem. There are a number of different attempts that have been made. There are results that look at least as good as these results from 2 other laboratories. And so it's very premature. It doesn't mean it's not going to work. I don't want to say that I have any information about whether it's going to work or not. all I can say is the kinds of signals they're getting are expected at this stage. They don't necessarily mean that the vaccine will protect anybody. Or if they do protect it, how long they will protect them. There's a lot of questions that remain to be done. And eight people is a far too small study to know whether it's even safe. So, you know, I think making a big announcement that moves the market on a first-in-human study for eight people is an extraordinary event in biomedical science. It just doesn't happen. The fact that this has happened puts, I think we all understand why. We're all desperate to see an end to this disease. We have friends, we have children and grandchildren we're deeply worried about. We're all upset about the economy and the way this has changed our lives, and we are hoping for an end. But hope is not the answer. Really hard data is the answer to what's what we need, and we haven't seen that yet.
And that's Dr. Bill Hazeltine, Chairman, President of Access Health International. That historical perspective, but also hearkening back to our theme last week, Carol, a little bit of a reality check. We caught up with him, and it's important to note, you know, these were conversations that we taped throughout the week. We were talking to him on a day where the market was ebullient over the Moderna vaccine results, those very early results. And I liked what he said because it made us, I think, take a much more realistic view. And the week really bore that out.
Well, and I love what he said. Hope is not the answer. We need real hard data. Ultimately, that is what we need to get ahead of this virus. All right, you're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, a conversation about small business with Facebook CEO Sheryl Sandberg and the survey that they have done that shows one-third of small businesses, they have stopped operating.
A bleak landscape for sure. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, today we're bringing you some of the most important, we hope, informative conversations we had on our daily Bloomberg Business Week radio show this week. We're talking about an economy reopening, but we're also talking about an economy, Carol, that is totally and fundamentally and maybe permanently changed.
Yeah, and nowhere do you see that more starkly than with small business. Facebook, in fact, had some news, Jason, this week about a recommitment to commerce with small business. They announced a new digital storefront. It's called Shops. They also released the results of a survey about the virus's impact on small business. And for that, Jason, we caught up with Facebook's COO, Sheryl Sandberg. We heard more about the survey results, and she brought along a small business owner, Simi Adebajo, owner of Eco. They both joined us from the West Coast.
This survey is quite devastating. You know, we started working on this actually before coronavirus with the Small Business Roundtable, and we thought we'd put a survey out, you know, the state of small business, and it would be very, very positive, right? Unemployment at historically low levels, entrepreneurship thriving, and then coronavirus hit. And the picture we got back was sobering, but I think even more important. More than a third of small businesses have stopped operating entirely. 11% expects to fail if things don't change within the next few months. And the stat that really hit me was more than half of small business owners don't think they're going to be able to rehire their employees.
Absolutely. So, Simi, you had this exact experience. So help us understand exactly what happened. I mean, your story has something of a happy ending, but that devastation that Sheryl talked about, I mean, you experienced it firsthand right off the bat.
So I experienced it firsthand because when this whole thing hit, I had to let go of my whole team and shut down my business for the first 3 to 4 weeks. And it's not just me. I guess all restaurant owners and small businesses in San Francisco, especially because of the overhead that comes with being a business in the city, once you have 1 week, 2 weeks without customers or your usual stream of revenue, you are hemorrhaging funds. And I saw very quickly, my restaurant is located in the SoMa neighborhood. Once my business closed, I started to see all the other restaurants and corner stores around starting to take the same lead. Fortunately for me, I connected to an organization that's a nonprofit that's feeding the homeless and the elderly and generally vulnerable populations in the city right now. So I was able to, within the past 2 weeks, rehire my core team. And, you know, that's a positive story, but that's not going to be the case for many small businesses who are just not going to be able to rehire their core staff Another issue, or maybe it's not an issue, but one main problem that small business owners are having getting their teams back lies within the fact that the employees are sometimes making more on unemployment than they would be making coming to work, especially now with California's additional $600 payment. There's really no incentive for them to go back to work. So it's a tough time all around for small businesses right now.
So Cheryl, when you see the results of the Facebook survey, and we've been talking often a lot about, you know, what needs to be done, especially for small business. We just came off a conversation, you know, about, you know, 70% of our backbone is small businesses, and it's going to be tough for them to resist going back. So what do you see as kind of the necessary components to protecting our small business community, making them safe so that they can come back safely when the environment changes?
So look, you know, part of it is bridging until we get there. So obviously the government loans matter. We put $100 million to work in just grants to small businesses all around the world. We earmarked $40 million of that for the United States and half of that for women, minority, and veteran-owned businesses, because we all know that when crisis hits, the most vulnerable get hit the hardest. And so we all need to do everything we can to bridge. We're working on more products that help small businesses go online if they weren't online before. To the extent they can, they need to do more online, more reaching customers online, more providing services online. And then once they come back to work, how do we do that safely? We see curbside checkouts. We see people doing art classes online. There's an amazing story of a bookstore that's located in University City, Missouri. They're called I See Me, and they're really for Black children to discover role models and learn about African American history. But it's very much a community-based thing where everyone went there in person.
Right.
They're now doing those same storylines online.
Right.
Local businesses are going to have to be able to morph to do more things online, and that's what we're seeing.
So, Cheryl, I wonder what you make, especially given your background. You worked at the Treasury Department. You understand the inner workings of government really well, the balance between the public and the private. What does the government need to do in the short and midterm to ensure that private efforts like the one that you just described can be successful in the long term? What do we need from the government at this point?
Well, when you ask that question, I feel like it's really all hands on deck. We need local government, state government, national government to be helping bridge for companies, which they are, but also helping us keep safe. You know, as we open up, how do we do it to protect everyone, make sure our hospitals don't get overrun, make sure that information is clear and flowing? I think, you know, we've been through a lot, but there is a lot ahead of us, and it has to, again, be everyone doing their part.
And I do think about what's interesting is this is a time, as you know, I feel like the tech industry was largely on everyone's radar. A lot of scrutiny was happening. Do you see this time, you know, you talk about the things that you guys are doing to help bridge the gaps for small businesses. Is this a time to kind of potentially, you know, improve your image? You know, the government has been looking and politicians. I'm just curious how you see that.
So we've been trying to do the right thing all along, and when we've made mistakes, work hard to correct them and prevent them next time. You know, right now we're just rolling up our sleeves and doing everything we can to help small businesses get through it, roll out products that can help them, you know, things like fundraisers for small business. You know, we had fundraisers for nonprofits. We had fundraisers for, you know, people, but we never would have rolled out fundraisers for small business until this crisis.
Mm-hmm.
We are just focused on putting our efforts to what can help. And we believe if we do the right thing, people will figure that out and believe that we are over time.
That's Facebook CEO Sheryl Sandberg and small business owner Simi Adebajo, owner of Eco, talking really about small businesses, what's going on, and what needs to happen to help them stay alive and come back.
I have to say, you know, I was thinking back over that conversation, and I think you mentioned this later on in the week, you know, this notion that, you know, Sheryl Sandberg, we talked with her about the personal effect. You know, she has been sheltered in place like so many people, and yet her fiance's family, part of her family, you know, frontline healthcare workers. So she has a sense, as many of us do, about what it's like beyond our, you know, sort of cosseted worlds that we are fortunate to live in, that there are people really fighting this every day. And certainly that goes back to small businesses who many, in many cases, if you're talking about restaurants and even some retailers, they're on the front lines as well.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And bottom line, she said, in terms of small businesses, more of them are going to have to morph and go online to really survive.
You're listening to Bloomberg BizWeek. Coming up, staying with tech, we hear about a new e-commerce app that just launched this week. It's bold.
Yeah, absolutely. Coming into a rough environment. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly from Bloomberg Radio.
We're bringing you some of the most important and informative conversations we had throughout the week on our daily radio show. And of course, we have to remind everybody, news was happening constantly crossing the Bloomberg. So all of this happening in real time.
Well, and a reminder, Carol, that business marches on, and also in times of crisis and in times of disruption, some of the biggest ideas emerge. We caught up with Julie Bornstein. She launched her new e-commerce app. It's called The Yes. This week, they delayed it back in March. She has an incredible history in the world of retail and e-commerce. She worked at Nordstrom. She was the COO of Stitch Fix. Check it out.
The Yes is a new shopping platform that makes shopping for women's fashion more fun, easier, and smarter than anything that exists today. So the idea is it's an app that is tuned to each user. You come onto the app and you fill out a profile that's a fun Q&A, and then you see brands and themes and styles that you like in your own home feed, and everybody's home feed is different, and you can search on anything that you're looking for. You can discover new brands. We always recommend what size you should get, and it's free shipping both ways, so to buy and to return.
We're going to talk a little bit more about it, but I'm just curious about the launch. Did you think about holding off, or did you feel like this was an ideal time because there are so many people home at this point?
We actually did hold off. We were originally planning to launch in late March, and
okay,
because of COVID hitting, we needed to step back and reevaluate, and then we kind of watched what happened. But we were noticing that, obviously, with retail closing, a lot of our brands were losing sales that they would have gotten otherwise, and we have small brands and big brands, and their orders were being canceled for the fall, and so we really felt like we wanted to step in and help. And the truth is, people need a little levity in their life, and it's a really fun app to play with. So we did decide to make a donation for every download to Good Plus Foundation to help families in need. But we decided that this time was as good as any,
right,
given how crazy the world has become.
Our guest at this hour is Julie Bornstein. She is someone who understands the retail industry, former chief operating officer of Stitch Fix, former chief digital officer at Sephora, and she just launched today her e-commerce startup. It's called The Yes. And, you know, Julie, we were just getting into it, and it's tailor-made experiences, and you use sophisticated algorithms. How exactly does it work?
On the back end, what's happened is we've built an algorithm that really understands fashion deeply. So we built a very deep taxonomy to understand every dimension of fashion, which includes all the style elements and the price and the brand and the construction. And so we've started to understand fashion in a way that we can train data models to understand. And then we spent time learning about customers, and we ended up building a tool that is ultimately kind of what Spotify is to you for music. And so the consumer can come on, they answer some Q&A, and then they have a home feed that is really built around them. And the more that you yes and no items in the home feed and in your search results, then you tune the app to you. So it really creates this very great and very hyper-personal experience. And of course, we need a very large assortment of brands. So we have over 150 of the best fashion brands, from very high-end to Jimmy Choo and Ralph Lauren to kind of great everyday brands like Levi's and Madewell. So you can shop high and low or however you'd like.
So what's the biggest lesson? I mean, what do you take from all of that experience that Carol laid out about sort of the shopper and especially synthesizing in, Julie, sort of what's going on now with our behavior and our sort of whole worlds being upside down? How do you, pun intended, sort of stitch all that together into something new?
It's a great question. This is something we've been working on for 2 years, primarily because, as we've all seen, as e-commerce grows, the more product that's sold online, the more websites there are, the more overwhelming shopping becomes.
Yeah.
And I think now, in this moment in time, when we can't go to stores yet, we are more reliant on shopping online than ever. And the experience for most users is very overwhelming, especially in a category like fashion that's so nuanced and there's so many options. And so really our goal was, how do we help each user kind of cut through the clutter and surface the relevant product for them, whether it's things they know and love or it's new brands they may never have heard of.
And that's Julie Bornstein from The Yes. My only disappointment, Carol, is that they're only selling women's clothes right now. As we chatted with her about, about, like, I need a new place to buy my t-shirts and jeans.
Yeah, exactly. What I thought was great about this conversation, there was a lot of retail news this week overall. We heard from the retailers across the nation. What she said, ultimately, she doesn't think brick and mortar is going to go away, but some stores will not make it. But she thinks, ultimately, e-commerce is going to get better as a result of the virus.
Well, and this whole notion that one of the things we love about going shopping is that sort of serendipity, that discoverability. Mm-hmm. And if you can figure out from an artificial intelligence perspective, essentially how to teach a machine to surprise you, I feel like that's kind of cool.
It is cool. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, we catch up with the president and CEO of Porsche Cars North America, Klaus Zellmer, back with us. He reminded us, Jason, of our time with him last fall. Remember when he brought Porsche's first fully electric sports car to our offices, the Taycan. Man, that seems like a decade ago.
It really does. It's a cool car, and they're actually selling out of them. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, today we're bringing you some of our favorite conversations from our Bloomberg Business Week daily radio show from this week. Real-time news, obviously, Carol, and the theme certainly is reopening.
It is reopening, and with that in mind, we caught up with Klaus Zellmer, the president and CEO of Porsche Cars North America. He, like most of us and his team, it is his 10th week from working from home, and yet most of their dealers are back.
In March, beginning of March, we had a big event, Amelia Island, which was classic cars and lots of fun, and then this crisis hit us. So I'm personally now in my 10th week working from home with the whole of Porsche Cars North America basically working from home. The good thing is that our dealers are now back opening up their operations. So we are at 85% of back to business throughout the country. And the May retails actually look pretty promising in the first half of this month. But yes, we had to take, of course, also a big hit in April, where more than half of our dealers were actually closed for sales.
Talk to us a little bit more about May. You said May is starting to look promising. What are you seeing in terms of, and what are you hearing about activity of people getting out there, looking at cars, maybe even, you know, signing on the dotted line to place an order?
I think we're seeing a new normal. I think we're seeing people that, of course, digitally engage. They want us to respect their safety. They want us to sanitize their car. They want us to pick up their cars for service or repair and bring them back without ever touching them. They want us to deliver a new car that they have purchased online to their house, dropping the keys and then doing a video explanation of how the car works. So I think it's two things. It's one, that our dealers are back in business, but they have adapted to the new normal, which just involves a lot more digital business.
And how does it change does it change, Klaus, the economics of that process? I mean, does it change the type of staff you hire, the amount of staff that you hire, the investments that a dealer has to make? Like, walk us through the implications of that sort of changed process.
Well, I think the short-term effect is that it is more expensive from a cost point of view to conduct that type of business because you still have your fixed assets, you have your investment, you have your depreciation that you have to handle in your balance sheet. So, you know, you can't drop that from one day to the other. And, of course, you know, there's a lot of work involved in keeping everything clean, super clean, you know, cleaning cars every time for you know, service incidents, every time anybody touches them, you know, your productivity of your space is limited because you have to keep social distancing a priority. So short term, it's going to be higher cost. Longer term, if people really consider this being their preferred way of conducting business, then of course you have to invest less.
Right.
But for sure, I can say that people actually like the personal interaction and the relationship, and I hope that stays going forward.
What's interesting is I do love how you guys literally have kind of tapped into what is going on, where more people, obviously you have to do social distancing, but more people are doing things either virtually or socially online. You guys have a new app you put out on how individuals and consumers can track their purchase of a new Porsche. Tell us a little bit about that and why you did it. Is it just kind of playing into what's going on in this world?
I think it just fits into this new world because, you know, you want to know what's going on out there. And, you know, a purchase of a Porsche is more driven by your heart than by your brain. And so, you know, you want to be engaged with that car being built. And now we actually provide with this Track Your Dream app, we provide the possibility to see when the car is in production, when it leaves our production site in Germany, when it's on the vessel. You can even see a picture on that app of the vessel where your car currently is, when it arrives in America in your port, and when it's then in transition from the port to the dealership and when it's ready to be picked up. So you can basically follow through the whole process of ordering the car being produced, until it's actually in your own garage.
And so, Klaus, tell us about demand from a regional perspective, because, you know, one of the things we know, and we were just talking to one of our colleagues down in your neck of the woods, it is, you know, the view is a little bit different in the Southeast versus the Northeast versus the Midwest versus the West Coast. Help us understand, you know, how that has affected, you know, where you're selling and maybe where you're seeing sales a little slower.
Actually, of course, you know, New York has been hit hard, and we can see that in our sales numbers. But we have four areas we subdivided the United States in, which is central, which is basically central and north, and then west, east, and south. Mm-hmm. South has actually been pretty stable. And east has been hit the hardest, and then west, and then central, which is central and north, is not such a strong area for us in terms of sales. So where April really hurt was on either sides of this country.
Let's get back to our conversation with Klaus Zellmer. He is, of course, president and CEO of Porsche Cars North America, joining us on the phone from Atlanta. And as we discussed a little bit earlier, one of the ways we got to know Klaus was with the introduction of the Taycan, both with a visit to our Bloomberg headquarters, but also it was the subject of a Super Bowl advertisement that Klaus talked to us about. So, Klaus, give us a Taycan update. What's happening with the car?
Well, the car is performing extremely well.
Yeah.
The only downside of it is that we will not be able to fulfill the demand that we currently still see in the market here in North America. So our supply will be short, which is, of course, missed opportunities, but it's better this way than the other way around.
Yeah. So how short? Can you quantify that for us?
Well, you know, that's really difficult. Our order bank currently is about double the cars that we will be able to deliver to North America at this point of time. But of course, you know, you can not always be sure about the orders reflecting the real demand, because some people put various orders with various dealers because they want to increase their chances to then get the cars. But we certainly know that our demand exceeds our supply that we will be able to get from Germany this year.
Hey, Klaus, what do you make, though, of, like, supply chains? Are you guys rethinking any of that because of what's happened with the virus? And also on a day when we heard from President Trump earlier about, you know, whether it's the, you know, medical equipment that's needed, you know, God forbid that we go through something like this in the future, that everything needs to be made, you know, in America. I just wonder how you are looking at things and, like I said, global supply chains right now.
Yeah, I think, of course, you know, everybody wants to be in, if you sell in a country, you want to produce in that country, but it also has to financially make sense. And Porsche is such a small car company. If you take the U.S., for example, our market share is 0.3%. So if you take 1,000 cars that are sold new at any point of time, three of those are Porsche. So we don't have the scale to have factories across the globe. We only have factories in Germany at this point of time. So we will have to live for the foreseeable future with the fact that we produce cars where it makes sense in terms of quality assurance, our investment, and, you know, getting our money back there and then shipping the cars over, as much as we would love to have a bigger scale and then produce in the United States as well. Financially, that's not viable.
And so when you think about sort of the mega trends that are underneath all of this, especially, you know, you've spoken with us before about, you know, the overall companies and the North American divisions, you know, pretty aggressive move toward electrification and sort of the industry is certainly moving that way. What does this mean for that sort of overall plan? Does it slow it down? Does it accelerate it a little bit? Or does it change it in any way?
I think the overall new car demand this year will, of course, be way below last year's demand.
Right.
So it could be anything between 15, possibly 30% less new cars sold this year. Now, if you take the gas price at the moment, and some people actually buy an electric car because the electricity is cheaper than the equivalent you need to invest in gas to run your car. That's, you take that away, so battery electric vehicle as a whole are not really being pushed the way that we would like to see them, awarding them the investments that have been made by the industry. But I see that something that is a short-term effect. We hopefully get back to the normal situation with gas prices and, of course, with cars that technologically are advanced, and the demand for that in the second half of the year.
Are you rethinking your electrification plan at all?
No, you can't, because we make our decisions, you know, with any car that you see launched this year, the decision has been made 5 years ago. And that's the same for any car manufacturer. Developing a car from scratch is a 4 to 5 year cycle that you will have to calculate in. So anything that happens right now is happening because we made those decisions 4 to 5 years ago.
That's Klaus Zellmer, the president and CEO of Porsche Cars North America. And, you know, what's interesting is, like the rest of us, they are adapting. His dealers, he talked about adapting, doing more with consumers and Porsche owners online. He says it's more expensive. And, Jason, you know, they're going to have to wait and see if that continues longer term and whether they're going to have to make a big shift.
Well, and it's also impacted their ability to make and deliver cars. They've got a backlog, which in normal times is good news, and he's happy about the fact that demand is there for that Taycan that we have had an experience with, at least sitting in it. We've never been able – he's never given us one to drive around. So maybe on the other side of this pandemic, we'll get to take it for a test drive. And that wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Jason Kelly.
And I'm Carol Masser. Plenty coming up in our next hour, including when you want to know about the hospitality industry, you got to check in with Ian Schrager.
Plus, we take you inside the magazine's cover story. It's provocative and asks the question, are we gambling on a resurrection?
Right, and looks at maybe another way of coming back. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly from Bloomberg Radio.
Hello, I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. Today, we're bringing you some of our favorite conversations we had during the week on our daily Bloomberg Business Week radio show. Carol, week 10, we're still obviously enveloped in all senses, physically, economically, by the impact of this virus. But we're starting to think about the way forward, and it is complicated.
Jason, I'm just going to say, get ready, everybody, for some thoughtful and very thought-provoking conversations, including one with Tom Siebel. He's the founder and CEO at C3.ai. Tom is just one of those thinkers that you want to sit down and talk to for hours.
That's exactly right. And someone we were also very excited to catch up with was Ian Schrager. He visited with us about a year ago. My, how the world has changed.
Well, and I'm just going to say, everybody, get ready to learn about hustle and float. You may never work the same again. We're going to catch up with Rahaf Harfouch. She has a new book out and a concept about productivity and really how to work smarter.
This one definitely stuck in my brain. You and I have been quoting this back to each other ever since we had that conversation. But first up, we take you inside the magazine, The Cover Story. It's by economics editor Peter Coy. It's got a provocative title, the headline alone, Trump is gambling on a resurrection with lives and livelihoods. He also presents an alternative way forward. We spoke with Peter and magazine editor Joel Weber.
So Peter and I have been sort of having ongoing conversations about obviously the biggest story in the world right now, which is A, not only the virus, which I think he's done an amazing job covering, but the economy, which is the other thing that he covers really well. And I basically sort of asked him to say, like, okay, what's our take? What's this going to mean going forward? And the outlook is the thing that as business leaders, I think everyone's wrestling with, like, what's this thing going to look like going forward? And so when we started talking about that, I said, I think one of the things that we have to bring in here is a conversation about President Trump and sort of this mismanagement of the virus from the outset. And also now almost the mismanagement of perhaps reopening too soon. And if that goes, not well, that's going to have a serious impact on the economy. It's also a gamble for his reelection campaign. And when we started talking about that, Peter goes, well, there's this thing called gambling on a resurrection you should know about. And I'll use that as a way to transition to Peter. Peter, what's gambling on a resurrection?
Right. Term from game theory. So the idea would be, if you're behind in a game, it could be any game, it could be a football game or running for election or a laboratory experiment, then you, if you just play by conservative normal rules, you'll probably lose. Whereas if you gamble, take a big chance, there's some chance that it will pay off and you'll be very happy. And if it doesn't pay off, well, you're going to lose anyway, so no big deal. You'll see that a lot of executives who are losing money and are trying to keep their jobs will gamble for resurrection. And it's up to the shareholders to discipline them and make sure they don't, gamble too much in a way that ends up harming the company. So I said, well, we can carry that analysis over to the United States, the federal government. Trump is taking a fairly big risk that this reopening will work, that there will be relatively few extra deaths and that the economy will rebound, and then he can win re-election. That's good for him, but it's also good for the country if it actually works out that way. Let me just finish with the downside quickly. The downside scenario is that he loses, which he probably might have done anyway, but the country loses more than it would have under a conservative approach, because there are more deaths and the economy does not reopen quickly because you're getting resurgences and re-shutdowns and people are afraid and they're staying home.
Exactly. Like, it gets to this whole idea, by postponing, do you improve or reduce the impact by delaying the open? I feel like it's the big question that everybody's debating. The problem is, this isn't a game. This is, you're dealing with people's lives and livelihoods. So I do wonder, kind of how you see it. What's the alternative way of kind of approaching this versus maybe what we're getting from President Trump?
Well, what we're hearing from a lot of epidemiologists is that you need to have, you need to move gradually. Open the things that are most critical and where the risk of new outbreaks is the smallest, and then keep shut the things that where the upside of reopening is relatively small and the risk is great. So, for example, we've heard Trump recently saying he can't wait to see, sports stadiums filling up again. And I'm thinking, really? That's exactly the last thing you should want to open, just because there's so much exposure. Once one person, asymptomatic person carrying the virus, could expose dozens or hundreds of people in a single afternoon watching a football game or something.
And that's economics editor Peter Coy and, of course, Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber. This is a big one in many ways. And Peter Coy, he's incredibly prolific. He also, every now and again, goes hard.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do feel like, Jason, it's the question and debate of our time. Reopening the U.S. economy too soon? What are the health risks? Too late? Then what cost to the economy and the livelihood of Americans? Peter really delves into maybe a better way of doing it.
All right. You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek. Coming up, Tom Siebel, another very thoughtful guy. Mm-hmm. He's the founder and CEO of C3.ai, of course, as well as his namesake eponymous company that was so famous, really set the standard in many ways in the software business in Silicon Valley. He's got a new project, and it is fascinating.
Right. It's all about COVID-19 data collection and sharing that with the world to help end the pandemic. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly from Bloomberg Radio.
We're bringing you some of the most important and informative conversations we had throughout the week on our daily radio show. There were so many of them. These are just some of our favorites. And just a reminder, everybody, it was happening in real time as the news continued to evolve around us.
And we got to catch up with Tom Siebel, Carol. I really enjoyed talking to him. So thoughtful. He's the CEO now of C3.ai. He's the author of a book that we had talked about when it came out, Digital Transformation, Survive and Thrive in an Era of Mass Extinction. Also, of course, you know by the name, the founder of Siebel Systems, one of the best known and most influential companies in the history of Silicon Valley. But he's got a new company, and this whole concept of a data lake, it's fascinating.
In Northern California, I would say that there's really been very little impact from COVID. In the county that I'm in, San Mateo County, this would be everything right north of Palo Alto and Silicon Valley. We have 750,000 people as the population. There are 1,700 hospital beds. And on any given day, there might be 50 people hospitalized with COVID. If you look at Santa Clara County, which is the county immediately south of us, where there's roughly 2 million people, that would be everything from Palo Alto to San Jose, there's about 2 million people, 4,000 hospital beds. On any given day, there'll be 150 people hospitalized for COVID. In San Mateo County, I believe there are no people on ventilators. Most people in the town that I live in, Woodside, there have been 10 people diagnosed with COVID, so it kind of missed us.
Well, I mean, there's an argument meant to be made, I think, Tom, and I'm guessing some of your local lawmakers would make it, which is you guys did the right thing. I mean, you sort of shut it down pretty early in the entire Bay Area, right?
We did shut it down early, and it kind of, you know, I think the purpose for shutting it down was to keep from overwhelming the hospital systems.
Right.
And we never got close to that. I mean, out of 1,700 hospital beds on any given day, 50 might be occupied with, in this county, 50 might be occupied with COVID patients. So it, you know, maybe it worked. There's lots of different opinions on this, but it kind of never happened here.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, let's hope it stays that way.
Yeah, exactly. Lesson learned, you know, in terms of a playbook for how to do it.
Are you guys in the studio or are you doing this from home?
We're doing it from home.
We've been doing it from home.
Good for you. It's not what a pretty, you guys are a professional operation. it's seamless professionalism. Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, we've gotten good at it. We're at the end of our ninth week doing this from home. So, kudos to our team who got us all set up. But it is sort of, it's an amazing tribute to technology, Tom,
yeah,
which you know far more about than we do. So let's talk about how technology is maybe helping us get our arms around this. We were talking with you earlier in the year about cyber attacks. We've got a different sort of attack on our hands now. And I do wonder how technology and this whole concept of a data lake, help us understand how that's being used here.
You know, you'll recall that one of the things we spoke of when I was with you last in New York was the area of precision medicine. Okay, and precision medicine unquestionably will be one of the largest commercial and industrial applications of artificial intelligence. So we can use this for disease prediction, adverse drug reaction, genome-specific medical protocols, AI-assisted diagnosis. So this is the largest and most rapidly growing segment of the U.S. economy and many economies, and AI is going to impact medicine in a huge way. Now, enter COVID. So this is a really unique opportunity to apply AI to contribute to this dialogue. And if we looked at all the, you know, everybody has just been guessing. And, you know, as you change from, you know, one TV channel to another and you listen to Neil Ferguson at King's College or the person at Stanford and one person says the, you know, the morbidity rate is going to be between 2% and 5% and another expert with the same level of expertise says the morbidity rate is going to be like, you know, 1/1,000th of 1%. What is a policymaker to do? Well, what we did is we formed a coalition that we call the C3 AI Digital Transformation Institute, and we founded this with Microsoft. We funded this to a tune of about $400 million, and we aggregated the human capital at MIT, Carnegie Mellon, Princeton, the University of Chicago, the University of Illinois, and UC Berkeley to engage in large-scale research on applying AI to mitigate COVID pandemic. And so this is AI and machine learning models to mitigate disease, bioinformatics, modeling and simulation of propagation. So that's a major initiative. It's underway. It's really exciting. And that is one of the efforts that we've been engaged in.
Tom, you really laid out what Data Lake is all about. What's your goal? So this is, you know, COVID-19 data collection. What are you hoping that it does, or what do you expect it to do, and what's a timeline on it?
Well, in order to perform data science, in order to get accurate predictions, whether it be course of disease or the efficacy of social mitigations, these scientists need data. So what we have done in the past month is we have taken the 22 largest data sources that are available in the world about COVID, from Johns Hopkins and COVID-19 and the New York Times and the Milken Institute and what have you. These are CT scans. These are mortality data, comorbidity, course of disease. And we have aggregated those data into a unified federated image that we've made available. This is called the C3AI COVID-19 Data Lake. And we've made this resource available to the world at no cost to be able to do research. And so this is by far the world's largest corpus of COVID data available to researchers. This is being powered by our friends at AWS, who provided the cloud platform to do it. And I think this will be an enormously important resource for people to research, to do research, understand the course of the disease, and control this epidemic and other epidemics like it.
And that's Tom Siebel, CEO of C3.ai. I got to tell you, Carol, this is one of those conversations that stuck with me. Part of it is tone, part of it is substance. And, you know, this was a guy that we clearly sort of caught at a moment where he's been thinking big thoughts.
Well, when we've had so much nationalism going on, populism going on, he is saying this has got to be a global effort. And, you know, it's all about large social research. None of this in terms of attacking the virus can be done in a vacuum. And he reminded us, and he's not only reminding us, he's actually making an effort to share all of the data so everybody can be working on a solution to COVID-19.
And that, of course, was just a part of the conversation that we had with Tom Siebel. For the full interview, be sure to check out our Business Week Extra podcast.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, entrepreneur, hotelier, and real estate developer Ian Schrager.
He's a legend. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, today we're bringing you some of our favorite conversations from the week on our Bloomberg Business Week daily radio show. Check that out, 2 p.m. Wall Street every day. And Carol, this week, it's about the road back.
Well, it is about the road back. And I have to say, a story crossed the Bloomberg about a hotel in Times Square, New York Times Square, which we know the city is shut down. Well, this hotel is shutting down. And it brought us back to Ian Schrager, who has come to our studio several times. He's an entrepreneur, a hotelier, and real estate developer. So I really wanted to get his perspective. Someone who has seen so many different cycles in the city wanted to get his perspective on where we are and what life looks like after the virus.
The hotel business is under siege. Public is closed, as well as a lot of the additions. But I look forward to them opening soon. I feel that we're seeing light at the end of the tunnel, and there'll be a lot of uncertainty involved. But I'm quite confident that we will return to normal, and business will get back, and we'll see happy days again.
Well, and Ian, you know, one of the reasons we wanted to make sure to talk to you beyond just your general wisdom and expertise is because you guys had to make the tough decision to close the Times Square edition about a year ago, give or take. You were with us talking about it opening, a lot of promise there, and Times Square, you know, in a totally different place than it was when you opened it decades before. Now, obviously, the city has been brought to a standstill. Help us understand what led ultimately to that decision.
Well, unfortunately, we got dragged into a dispute between the owner of the property and its financial institutions. The hotel is part of a larger component with a lot of retail, a big signage component, as well as lots of office space. The dispute has nothing to do with us. We hope it'll get resolved. The hotel was doing better than we expected. It received worldwide critical acclaim, and we're hoping we did close it for the pandemic, and we're hoping to welcome everybody back soon as the pandemic is over or under control.
So it's not a case, though, then, Ian, of, because I know there's been some thoughts about, I think there was another hotel that closed in the area, that, you know, problems for Times Square, especially in a post-virus or post-COVID-19 world. Do you see it that way or no?
No, I don't see it that way. You know, I've been hearing the pundits, everybody talking about a paradigm shift. And, you know, in my experience, and I think since biblical times, you never see a paradigm shift. You know, life finds a way. They make adjustments. They go on. Nothing changed after 9/11. Nothing changed after World War II, and so on and so forth. We always find a way, and we get back to normal, and we have to suffer all these predictions from all the intellectual people, I think. So I see things. Look, it's going to take a while. We're going to have to make an adjustment. We hopefully have to get a vaccine. But we'll deal with it the way we've dealt with every other calamity in the history of humanity. And it will return to normal, and New York is still New York, and Times Square is still Times Square, and it's just a question of riding it out and being prudent and making adequate plans and waiting for it to happen. And I don't see it being a long-term ramp up back to business. I see it being, you know, I can't tell for sure, obviously, but I think it, looking in terms of months, I think the bars and the restaurants will get started soon. There is a pent-up demand because, you know, the pandemic ends for the people before and at a different date than when the pandemic ends scientifically. And the people are raring to go. And you can see that when the bars opened up in Wisconsin and other places, they're packed. So, you know, I'm not an optimist by nature. I'm a realist, and I see this, returning to normal. Exactly when, I can't say. I think things will go back to normal.
That's Ian Schrager. And Jason, we know he's been building hotels. He's been changing the model for over 5 decades. He's now building residential buildings. It was so good to get his perspective on how things change and how we come back. He really understands crisis and rebuilding.
Well, and he understands New York. He understands city. And I dare say he understands human beings. I mean, this is a guy who was one of the creators of Studio 54 in many ways. He also redefined the way we think about hotels. And let me tell you, we got to think about hotels and travel and even just being human in a whole different way now.
You had me at Studio 54. Man, that was a great human experiment. I'm just going to put that out there.
It absolutely was. You're listening to Bloomberg BizWeek. Coming up, we hear from the author of a new book. We've been quoting this back and forth to each other all week. Hustle and Float, Reclaim Your Creativity, and Thrive in a World Obsessed with Work.
I love it. It's a reminder that, like Michael Jordan, we all need an off season. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Jason Kelly from Bloomberg Radio.
So we're bringing you some of the most important and informative conversations, those that really stuck with us throughout the week. They happened on our daily radio show, and it, of course, all related back to the virus, Jason.
Well, and it's a reminder that this has changed us as human beings. It's changed the way we relate to each other. It's changed the way we relate to our work. It's been a time of deep reflection for many. So a timely new book. It's by Rahaf Harfouch. She's a digital anthropologist, a professor. Her new book is called Hustle and Float, Reclaim Your Creativity and Thrive in a World Obsessed with Work.
In order for you to have the perfect whitewater rafting trip, you have to have the right amount and the equal balance between the hustle, when you paddle as hard as you can, and the float, where you lift your paddle up and let the river do the work. And if you do a trip with too much hustle, you'll get tired, exhausted, make mistakes, put yourself in danger. And if you don't have enough hustle and too much float, you'll end up aimlessly going where the river takes you and not where you want to go. And that really stuck with me as a professional, creative, and knowledge worker, because I think there's a lot that we can learn in terms of how we approach our own work and our own creative tasks.
So much hustle, Rob. I mean, that it is it is so true. We all see it. We see it in each other. We see it in our partners and our families and in our colleagues, especially, you know, especially working in big cities. And we definitely want to discuss sort of where we are in this, you know, upside down world. But I do want to ask you, how did we get to this point in your estimation where we just prize productivity so far above everything else?
The book took about 3 years to research, so I'm going to try to summarize that in maybe, you know, 15 to 20 seconds for you.
But perfect.
We created this very complicated story where we took these powerful, first of all, our powerful history. So think about the Puritan work ethic, think about the Industrial Revolution, and then think about the American dream, which is like one of the most powerful ideologies that has been exported all over the world, this idea that if you work hard enough, you will be successful. And what's happened is that over time, all of these ideas have kind of merged together, where now we have started to associate our identities, our self-worth, our contributions to society through this productive lens. And then we think, oh, well, if I'm successful, it's because I'm really busy. Or if I'm successful, it's because I'm really productive. And what we don't say is if I don't feel like I'm productive enough, it must be because I'm not working hard enough. Mm. So in essence, we've created a story that's supported by the media, by how you talk about successful people, by how hard they work, by what time they wake up in the morning, by how late they stay at the office. We've sort of created this idea that whatever we're doing is never quite enough. And if we want to reach that next pinnacle of success, the answer is obviously more hours, more time, more hustle. When the science actually says the opposite, the science says if you want to do more, you actually have to work less. But that's a message that's so hard for people to absorb when we're being told the opposite through social media and in the books that we read and the people that we hold up on a pedestal.
Drill down into that science, because, you know, how many books have we all read about someone who has achieved so much and it's like the first 20, 30 years of their life, all they did was work. You know, they didn't know their family, they didn't know anything, but look at the success that they've achieved. What's the science tell us?
The science tells us that creativity requires unstructured periods of time, that cognitive tasks take a drain on your mind, and you cannot just sit there and do highly complex, highly intense tasks for hours at a time. So if you want to do more work, you have to create a performance system that is built for your brain instead of just packing your days full of work. That is what the science says.
So I had a friend just text me, Rob, a friend of the show. He's the president of his own company. And he said, all right, so how much hustle and how much float? What's the right mix?
Good question.
I think it really depends on the individual. Everyone has their own different cycles. But I love that he's asking the right question. The right question is, how do we create systems that reframe high performance in a way that actually works with us and not systems that we just adopted from like historical baggage? So there's no, you know, easy fix, but it's the right question to start asking.
So this is like, I feel like our own little session here. So what are the things like you should be looking at to say, okay, I got to take this off my plate. Like, how do you approach it?
You have to approach it by recognizing that we've all been sort of brainwashed, because this isn't about me coming on the show and being like, hey guys, take a break, or hey, take a nap. Like, we all know that this is what we should be doing. The bigger question is, why don't we do it even though we know it's in our best interest? And it's when you start unraveling this complicated relationship that we have with being successful and hustling and being hyperproductive and being secretly proud that we're so busy and so tired all the time. When you start to get into why that relationship with work exists and what that represents in our lives, then you can start making these positive changes. Like, I'm not coming around saying, hey guys, I've got this crazy new idea, you know, take a nap and don't work so much. It's, we all know that we have to do that, but high performers don't, because we are so used to linking any time that's not spent working as time that's not spent striving towards our goals. And that's not true.
There are Silicon Valley companies. I remember visiting Pixar years ago, and there were basketball courts, and there was a basketball course, and a barbecue pit. And they made it so that If somebody wanted to work in the wee hours, they could do it. If they wanted to at 2 p.m, go out and play a game, you could do it. Like, is it that kind of atmosphere that we need to be embracing, or you're talking something a little bit more different?
Even companies that have these types of features, oftentimes they'll notice that workers won't take them and won't use them, not because they're afraid of what, say, their bosses would say, but they're afraid of what their colleagues would think and about how their colleagues would perceive, you know, their dedication to the job. So again, it's not just about having these features available. It's about really understanding that you have to reframe how you think about high performance, that investing in intentional recovery time. You guys talked about Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan has whole off seasons, right?
Yeah.
There's a whole off season for him to recover, and he's very intentional about that, for him to push his body in that way he needs to rest. We have to approach high performance the same way, because what we're all doing is we don't have any off seasons. We just pretend like we're working as hard as Michael Jordan all year round, and then we wonder why burnout has become a global situation, you know, as categorized by the World Health Organization.
Yeah. It's a really interesting point, that the whole notion of an off season. So Rahav, you know, as I think about where we are in this pandemic, we've all had this experience of our worlds being turned upside down, and I think for some of us who are very fortunate, you know, there has been in some ways less work or less commute, or, you know, sort of less time devoted to certain things that ate up a lot of our hours, and that's been very eye-opening. At the same time, and I know you've seen this and you've studied it much more in depth than we have, we've also seen this notion of the lines have blurred so completely, because our home is our office and our office is our home, and, you know, folks are trying to educate their kids and get their work done and get on the right Zoom call and things like that. How does this all net out? How do we make this a time, again, for those of us who can have that luxury to reset a bit?
It goes back to that intentionality, and it goes back to understanding the role that productivity plays in your lives. For many people, productivity and being busy has been seen as a psychological coping mechanism. We were told if you're busy enough and successful enough and productive enough, you'll be safe. And now we're experiencing economic turbulence, and suddenly people don't know what to do with themselves. And so they're redirecting a lot of that productivity into their personal lives, not realizing that it's also draining them. And let's not forget, in times of economic turbulence, people are going to work more because they're scared to show their boss that, you know, that they're indispensable. So that's what they want to do. So you also have a lot of psychological fear-based behaviors that are making people not speak up when they should have, because they think, I'm so lucky to have a job, I'm not going to raise my hand and say I'm not going to answer this email. So I think we really have to start at the top with leaders and companies recognizing that high performance requires intentional recovery, period. And that requires rethinking performance metrics, business, like how the business is business goals, and the realistic tasks that can be accomplished, considering that many companies think, oh, well, everyone's working at home. It's like, no, this is not normal time. These are not normal circumstances. And so we should not be acting like everyone should be doing the same level of work they were doing before the entire world went into lockdown. Like, that's just not realistic.
So it has to start with leaders.
It has to, yeah, because no matter what I tell you, if your boss sends you an email at 10 p.m. or on Sunday night, most people are going to answer. You're not going to say no to your boss, right?
Right.
So there's a pressure that comes explicitly down that if it's not clarified in terms of boundaries, again, I can give you all the tips and all the nap rooms and all the foosball tables, but if your boss is acting in a way that is generating these signs of overwork because they don't have clear expectations or boundaries, you're going to go along with it because you don't feel a sense of strong enough security right now to be able to say anything, because people are very lucky to have a job and they're very afraid of losing their jobs.
Rahav, just got 30 seconds. Final thoughts for everybody.
Final thought is, look at your sense of resistance and look at how you talk about your busyness and whether you're really upset that you're busy or you're kind of secretly glad that you're busy.
Yeah.
And start to ask yourself, how much is what I do linked to who I am? And start the work there. And I guarantee you, if you dig deep into it, you will produce your best work.
And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. Be sure to tune in to Bloomberg Business Week Radio. It's live Monday through Friday, starting at 2 p.m. Wall Street time.
You can also watch the show live on YouTube. Just search for Bloomberg Global News.
And be sure to check out our Bloomberg Business Week Extra podcast. That's right, it's plural this week. We're bringing you two. We talked about Tom Siebel. You want to check that one out. But also Richard Edelman. He is the founder and CEO of the global communications firm Edelman. He talked about the company's spring update to its annual trust barometer and how work and workers may be different on the other side.
What I love about both of them is they are looking at a world perspective when it comes to our life after the virus and actually tackling the virus. All right, everyone, we'll be back next week at the same time. Do stay safe.
This is Bloomberg.